All right, I do welcome you back to our Kings of Israel and Judah lessons. I handed out ages ago when we started the series, I handed out blank charts. The idea here is to for you to be able to jot down the things that stuck out to you and overall themes. I have a spot there for the years that king reigned. I have a spot for his enemies in particular, because that often appears in the prophets. So you can start to get a picture of who the enemies of Israel were at that time. But we've done King Saul and King David, and this week we're on King Solomon. And this is another king like David and Saul where we can't get anywhere close to covering everything that's said about him in Scripture. He is talked about in 2 Samuel and in 1 Kings and in 1 and 2 Chronicles. He also wrote Song of Solomon. He wrote most of Proverbs. He probably wrote Ecclesiastes, and he wrote two Psalms. So he's all through the Old Testament. He's an important figure. And Solomon is someone who has always puzzled me, has always fascinated me. He is such a contrast. It's almost a walking contradiction in some ways. He's the wisest of all people. God gave him special wisdom. And he's regarded as so wise. And yet, here he went and married 300 women and had 700 concubines. And of those 300, many of them were foreign women who led him into worshiping other gods. And so here we have the man who wrote Song of Solomon, the greatest expression of marital love and devotion in the Bible, and yet went off and married 299 other wives. And it's hard to put those things together. He built this magnificent, he built the temple of God. And we have this huge account of all the details of this amazing temple. And then he went across the valley and built temples and altars, not temples, he built altars to other gods. And you have such eloquence and such wisdom and such amazing words that he speaks in the prayers of dedication at the time when the temple was dedicated, and such evident knowledge of God, and I would say faith in God. And yet at the end of his life, his heart was turned by his wives to false gods. So he's a tough figure to reconcile in our minds. And I think I would say that he was saved, but it's hard to say how I say he wasn't, based on what's said about him and the way that God loved him, the way he loved God. But a man with serious major faults, serious sin that had massive ramifications for the people of God. And so he's an interesting figure. Again, we can't look at everything about him today, but we're gonna try to get an overall picture of Solomon here. So he was the most wise and prosperous king Israel ever had, but he was not good enough. And we'll come back to that here at the end of thinking that through and its relation to Christ. But from Solomon on all the way out, all the kings we're going to study, it's all going downhill from here. There are going to be faithful kings here and there, but in terms of the prosperity of God's people, in terms of peace, in terms of wisdom, Solomon was really a peak. His reign in terms of a reign really was the greatest that Israel ever experienced. So he was a king for 40 years. If you have your chart there, you can put down 970 to 931 BC for his years. That's an approximation, 970 to 931. There are a bunch of different ways that people calculate this, but 40 years from 970 to 931. Interestingly, we're never told how old he was. Many of the other kings were told how old they were. We know that Rehoboam was 41 when he became king, Solomon's son. So Rehoboam was already 1 year old when Solomon became king. So Solomon was old enough to have a one-year-old. So it's hard to know how young princes got married. He could have been a late teenager at that point, but certainly at least that old. And then at maximum, he would have been about 30 years old, I think. And we know he was born to David by Bathsheba. Bathsheba was his mother. And so we know that he was born after the incident with Uriah. He was born when David was king in Jerusalem. And he was sometime after that incident, because he was born, he had an older brother, their first baby with Bathsheba, who died, and then he was born after that at some point. So we can kind of get a picture of when he came on the scene, but we don't actually know how old he was when he became king. So I'm going to try to break down his life into four sections, into his birth and the things surrounding that, then his wisdom and prosperity and peace. So his birth, then his prosperous time, then building the temple, and then his downfall. So we're going to try to break things down that way, and then we'll look into some of the archaeology that we usually do, and then try to pull things together. So his birth, as I said, he was born to Bathsheba. He was the fruit of that relationship that started in such an awful way with David's sin against Bathsheba, and then sin against her husband Uriah, and then against so many other people in that situation. But we actually find out later on that the name Solomon was given to David for his son later, before Solomon was ever born. This was new to me as I was studying this. But in 1 Chronicles 22, verses 7 through 10, 1 Chronicles 22, 7 through 10, David is giving Solomon instructions about building the temple. This is the end of David's life. And he tells Solomon, when I wanted to build the temple, God told me not to. And that's familiar to most of you. David wanted to build the temple. God said, no, you're a man of blood. Your son is going to build the temple. But in 1 Chronicles 22, we're told that at that time, God told him, behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his surrounding enemies, for his name shall be called Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name. So before David had fallen into sin with Bathsheba, back in 2 Samuel 7, when God first told him not to build the temple, God already told him he was going to have a son named Solomon who was going to build the temple. So Solomon's one of those people that God gave the name to, kind of like Jesus, or who else did God? God gave a couple of names in advance. John the Baptist. Solomon's one of those. And Solomon, this is a good time to say the name Solomon is based on the word for peace. And you notice that when God told him, his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. So the Hebrew name is actually Shlomo. It's not Solomon, it's Shlomo, the great name. I don't know if you've seen that there are still Shlomos around these days, Jewish people named Shlomo. That's the name Solomon. Solomon is the Greek version of it. So we somehow have gotten to where we call him Solomon all the time, but that's actually Greek translation of Shlomo. But you can hear the word shalom in that, right? Shalom is peace. So Shlomo is based on the word for peace. So Solomon's the king of peace. So that's maybe one theme to keep connected with Solomon. He's the king of peace. This is the greatest peace that Israel really enjoyed during its time of the monarchy. So it's interesting then to think about the fact, this was new to me again this week, to think about the fact that before David ever sinned with Bathsheba, he already knew that he was going to have a son named Solomon who was going to be the king. And then he went and had this affair, and their first child died, and then he went in to comfort his wife, and she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. Now, David already had other sons, right? He had Absalom, he had Amnon, he had Adonijah, he had another one, Kileab. I think he only shows up once, but he had all these older brothers of Solomon's. But for whatever reason, at that moment, I don't know if it was that the Lord revealed it to him or that David just decided this is going to be the one who's the king. That David decided to name this son Solomon, and that's who became the king. And from there on out, it was known that Solomon was going to be king. And we don't have, and apparently David promised Bathsheba at that point, your son will be the king. We don't have that incident recorded, but when David was dying, then Bathsheba came to him and said, you promised me. And we have that recorded. Bathsheba and Nathan both came to him and said, listen, you promised that Solomon was going to be king. And David made good on that promise because Adonijah was trying to take the throne and David didn't let him do that. And so it's just interesting. There's some circumstances surrounding his birth that I was not aware of before, that God informed David in advance that he was going to be this king of peace. And then David chose that this son, I think it was David's choice, chose that this son born to Bathsheba was going to be his heir. And he made good on that promise. That's sort of where Solomon came from. But then when he became king, he really had, talking a little bit here about his wisdom and his prosperity, he really had the most prosperous reign of any king in the history of Israel. And you remember, many of you know, kids, do you know what happened when Solomon was first king and he had a dream and God talked to him and offered to give him anything? What did Solomon ask for? He offered to give him anything. And Solomon, he asked for wisdom, right? And God says, you could have asked for wealth, you could have asked for honor, you could have asked for the lives of your enemies, but you asked for wisdom. And because you did that, I'm going to give you all those other things too. And so that's where his wisdom came from. And that's also where his wealth and his honor came from. And so the quintessential example of his wisdom is that incident when the two mothers came, both claiming to have this baby was theirs. And he ingeniously was able to reveal who the true mother was by her care for this child. But that's the kind of wise king that he was. But it's interesting that his wisdom, when it's described in 1 Kings chapter 4, is not just wisdom in deciding court cases or wisdom in making good decisions as a king. It describes his wisdom in terms of knowing the natural world. It says that he talked about the beasts and the birds and of reptiles and of fish. He was a I don't know if you would call him a scientist, but he knew about the natural world, and he discussed and studied and observed the natural world. It also says that in that same context, it talks about him writing 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. And so he was a man of wisdom, not just in decision-making, but he was a Renaissance man in a sense. I just think it's interesting to think about the biblical picture of wisdom. It's not just making decisions. It's a breadth of interest. It's a breadth of knowledge. He's involved in literature and in the arts, writing these songs and things like that. And so there's maybe a broader picture of wisdom than we sometimes think. And then because of his great wisdom and wealth, another famous incident in his life was the Queen of Sheba coming to visit. And of course she said, I'd heard about you and thought it wasn't true, but it's even truer than I thought about his wisdom and his wealth. And the way that the Bible describes Israel in that time is just gushing and overflowing with talk of peace and prosperity and all these things. It says in 1 Kings 4, verse 20, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Later on in the chapter, it says, he had peace on all sides around him, and Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon. And it talks about him building ships and sending them off to bring back gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. And it says that in 1 Kings 10, he made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. And it almost sounds unreal, just how wealthy everything was, how everybody was living in peace. But you recognize, if you know your Old Testament history going back before that, you remember that God had promised Abraham that his descendants would be more than the sand of the sea, which is something that it just said about the population during that time, and that they would be a blessing to the nations. You see that happening with Solomon, blessing all the nations around him. So really, this is a sign of God's faithfulness to his promises, that he maintained the peace of Israel during this time. He gave them great prosperity, and that every man under his vine and every man under his fig tree is kind of the quintessential picture of shalom and prosperity and peace for God's people. And Solomon's reign is really when that hit its peak humanly or on this earth. And then a big part of that prosperity, or what Solomon devoted his prosperity towards, was building the temple. This is sort of the third section of his life. There's a lot of time spent in scripture on the building of the temple. One thing that I didn't know until a few years ago that I hadn't remembered was that First Chronicles tells us that David actually made a lot of the preparations for building the temple. So David didn't get to build it, but he did about everything he could except build it. David went and got all these resources and pooled all these things so that by the time Solomon came along, David kind of handed it to him and said, here you go. Here's all these things that you can use to build the temple. And Solomon just took that and took it up another notch. And he worked with Hiram, king of Tyre, for labor and for the lumber that he needed. And it took him 7 years to build the temple. And the dedication of the temple is a key part of Solomon's life. We have his prayers recorded. And if you haven't ever studied those prayers, I looked at them. They're a wonderful reminder of who God is and how we should speak to him. There's just a great richness and depth to the way that he addresses God and the things he's praying for. And he makes reference to the temple being a place of prayer, that there's a whole series of cases that he gives where he says, well, if your people do this and then they turn to this place and pray in this way, please answer them. And then if this happens and they turn to this place and pray in this way, please hear them. And if this happens, then, and they pray, then hear them. And so there's a lot to learn about prayer and about how God hears his people from those prayers of dedication. And that dedication time was kind of the pinnacle of temple worship. The number of sacrifices was so many, they couldn't even do it all on the altar. Again, it's just sort of overflowing with the devotion to the Lord and the prosperity at this time. Later on, when Hezekiah was restoring temple worship, we're told there was great joy. This is 2 Chronicles 30, 26. It says, so there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem. So again, he's kind of the peak of temple worship and devotion to the Lord. With all that said, all the wisdom, all the wealth, all the peace for Israel, Solomon had some significant sin in his life and a great downfall at the end of his life. But it wasn't just at the end of his life. There were some early signs of trouble. Right off the bat, he married the daughter of Pharaoh. And he married this Egyptian princess, and he put her, it's one of these, again, head scratchers, but Solomon, after he built the temple, realized the city of David needs to be a holy place. So I'm going to take my wife and move her a little bit outside of the city to another place because I shouldn't. So he went and married her, but then he decided he shouldn't have her in the holy city of David because he knew that he shouldn't have married her. And so it's a very strange case, but that was only the first of many, many, many marriages. But also early on, as early as 1 Kings 3, verse 3, it says, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David, his father, only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. So already at the beginning of his reign, he was sacrificing places he shouldn't have. There were just little hints of a half-heartedness, hints of abiding sin in his life. And it really comes to a head in 1 Kings 11, 1 through 3. It says, now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them. Neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. Oh, I had that flipped earlier. Sorry. 700 wives, 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. And by the end, it's at 1 Kings 11, verse 6. It says, so Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David, his father, had done. And then it says, and the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel. And it says, the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I've commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and will give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do this in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. So he's already the peak of the monarchy and he's already the downfall of the monarchy all at the same time. These sins that he had committed had such a lasting impact. And so under your enemies section there, he didn't have the enemies that most people had, most of the kings had, because he had such a time of peace in his life. But there at the very end, it mentions Hadad the Edomite. So the Edomites were enemies to Solomon. And then Rezin, the king of Damascus. So Damascus or the Syria were enemies of his. And then Jeroboam himself, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who ended up becoming the king of the northern tribes. Now, Jeroboam was an enemy of his. So he didn't have many enemies because he had such a time of peace. But there were a few of these, Hadad the Edomite, Rezin, the king of Damascus, and Jeroboam, son of Nebat. And then we hear all this glowing stuff about the infrastructure during his time and the wealth and all the, I didn't make reference to this, but it talks about his daily ration of food for all the people that were part of his government. And it's just unbelievable. With the bushels and bushels of grain and all of the meats and things that they had to do, all the cattle they had to slaughter every day just to feed all the people in his infrastructure. But it wasn't all good. In 1 Kings 12, verse 4, when Rehoboam shows up on the scene, when his son becomes king, the people come to him and say, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. So all that taxation, all of that big government wasn't necessarily a good thing. And all that prosperity came at a cost. He certainly did some of the things that kings of the nations did to use his people to his own advantage. So again, Solomon is an interesting figure who his reign had this precipitous rise and such amazing wealth and prosperity, and then such a fall at the end. I do, again, with the ways it talks about him loving the Lord and the Lord loving him and the things that he says, I have to come to the conclusion that he was a brother in the faith, truly believed, but his sins were so significant. And had such lasting ramifications. We don't have a lot in the archaeological record about Solomon. He goes, like I've said before, when we go back, the farther back we go, the fewer things we're going to have naturally. But I want to highlight a couple of things that have corroborated the idea of Solomon's reign being as great as it was. Because for a long time, liberal scholars have been saying Saul and David and Solomon didn't even exist. And they were at best, they were chieftains of some little tribe and they weren't that big of a deal. And there's one historian who famously said that David is just as historical as King Arthur. And there's been this idea that that kind of an infrastructure was not present at that time, but it was an argument from silence because they're saying, look, we haven't found any evidence of this big infrastructure and all these building projects and all these things that Solomon did. So clearly it didn't happen, but you have to be really careful with arguments from silence. And in biblical archaeology, especially, it's pretty great how often when we've been patient, eventually something shows up that starts to corroborate what the Word of God has already told us. And so this has been the case just in the last 10 or 15 years with respect to the reign of Solomon. What we're looking at here, I don't know if Zoom people can see it all, but these are foundation stones for a massive gate in the city of, I think this is the one in Hazor. But there are three of these gates that have been found in three cities. And the idea here is you can see sort of a central passage going through the middle, and then there are these chambers on the side of it. And this is called a six-chamber gate. And the idea was that you had these chambers on the side that you could use for storage, but also for defense. That if anybody was trying to come in the gate, they would be attacked from all sides from these six chambers. And so they were part of a big fortification of the city to protect it. And there are these three cities, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, that are actually all mentioned in 1 Kings 9, verse 15. And it says, this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house and the millo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. And so these were cities that Solomon built up and fortified. And sure enough, if you want to go to the next slide, at these three cities, we have found this very distinctive six-chamber gate, all built at the same time, all dated to right around 1000 BC, right around when Solomon was king. And so we have evidence here of a building project all the way across the land of Israel happening in these three different cities with the same style of gate fortified right at the time that the Bible says Solomon fortified the city. So that's a pretty neat corroboration of what we find in the Bible. And these are those foundation stones don't begin to really give you an idea of how big and impressive these structures were at the time. But you can see from the layout, these are very, very similar styles of gates. There was some news a few years ago, if you want to go to the next one there, some news about some copper mines that have been excavated recently. And the idea of King Solomon's mines has fascinated people for about 130, 40 years, ever since a fiction book was written called King Solomon's Mines, that about a lost place where they found all this treasure and stuff. And there's nothing in the Bible about King Solomon's mines in particular. Solomon had lots of precious metals, but the headlines made big news because they said they'd found the mines of King Solomon, when really that's more based on hype from a book than it is from the Bible. But these are mines, copper mines, down in the south, down in the area of Edom. And they have found evidence there of a significant mining operation that would have had to have relied on another significant set of things in the infrastructure at the time that show that there was a massive government and infrastructure at that time. Again, they used to say that wasn't the case. But if you go to the next slide, this is just a map of this big copper mining and smelting operation that someone has drawn. And they found things that particularly date it to the time of Solomon. So this was one of Solomon's sources of wealth, one of his sources of copper in that time. And so, again, it made more hype. There's more hype because of the King Solomon's mines thing. But it's another sign that there was quite a bit of infrastructure at the time. We go on to the next one. Okay, so this is, the picture doesn't show you much, but this is a site in Philistia where they've been digging up some graves there. And the lesson to be learned from this example is that if you don't brush your teeth, someone in 3,000 years will know what you've been eating for breakfast. Because they dug up these graves and they started scraping plaque off of these teeth, and they could analyze, do whatever mass spectrometer they use mass spectrometer to see what is in this stuff they've scraped off the teeth, and they can tell what these Philistines were eating. And one of the fascinating things that they found, this was, these are graves that date from right at Solomon's reign. One of the fascinating things they found is that these people were eating foods that had came from really far away. The Philistines were eating bananas, and you don't grow bananas in Philistia. And they probably, there were bananas. There was also soy and some other things that they weren't cultivating there at the time that must have come a long, long way. And so the bananas are probably dried bananas. We're not sure. But there was enough. And again, they said, if it showed up in the plaque like that, that doesn't mean they ate it once. That means it was something that was regularly a part of their diet, for it to show up, enough of it to show up that they could see it. And so here you have Philistines eating bananas right at the time of Solomon. And again, you think of the descriptions of Solomon and the trade that he was doing with East. And those bananas would have had to have come from pretty far East for them to be eating them. And it was coming with enough regularity that they were able, that it stuck in their plaques, on their teeth. So it's just another sign that we have such chronological snobbery, as I've heard it called before, where we say they couldn't possibly have been amazing as we are today. And so they must have been these backward, not as intelligent people who couldn't have done great infrastructure or trade. And sure enough, we find, as the Bible has told us already, they had trade going huge distances. They had an amazing market and things like that. So that was the last picture. So we'll leave it there for archaeological stuff. But I do want to remind you that there will be all kinds of arguments from silence about biblical archaeology. A while ago, they were saying camels didn't really exist as long ago as the Bible said. And then sure enough, or weren't domesticated. And then sure enough, we find evidence camels were domesticated as early as we thought. And so again, if you hear someone saying, well, there's no evidence, archaeological evidence for X, Y, or Z in the Bible, we just need to be patient. We may never find the evidence. We don't have to have that evidence to believe it. But it's amazing how much we are finding that does show us these things. So as we try to pull these things together and think a little bit about Solomon, the God's chosen king does bring peace and prosperity. And when you read the accounts of Solomon's reign, it sounds amazing, right? I mean, it sounds wonderful. The peace and the every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and there's no enemies attacking. It's wonderful. And what that should do is remind us of what Jesus brings to us and will bring to us when he restores this world perfectly. But we're looking forward to something so much better than Israel and Solomon's time. That prosperity and that peace is something that Jesus does give. We don't preach the prosperity gospel that you're going to have all that here and now. We follow Christ in the same trajectory of his life, where we follow in a path of suffering before we go to glory. But there is great peace and prosperity from the king. Solomon's that prototypical king of peace, prince of peace, and that wisdom and that wealth. And it's just a shadow again of what Christ will bring us. But Solomon also is the perfect example of the danger of marrying someone outside of the faith. And it's interesting that this actually comes up again later in Nehemiah 13. If you remember, in Nehemiah's day, he had all kinds of trouble with people marrying foreign wives. And here he's come all the way back from the exile, and they spent all this work building this wall, and then they start marrying these wives, and Nehemiah is just so angry, because he's saying, listen, they're going to lead you astray again. They're going to lead you down this other path. And if they don't believe the same faith that you do, they're going to take your hearts away. And what he says to them, he says, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. And that's the lesson we learned here, is that from Solomon, and in terms of our own lives and what choices we make, that do you really think that if Solomon, the wisest man in the history of mankind, and then the kings of Israel, this man of such great wisdom, if his heart was turned away, what makes you think that your heart won't be turned away by marrying someone who doesn't believe the same faith as you? It's a great warning to us that it really is deeply important that we not be unequally yoked. And then also, it's a reminder that even for believers, sin has deep and great and lasting consequences. Again, I do believe Solomon was a believer, but his sin had great consequences for him and for Israel. And so that should be a warning to us that, yes, we can think about, well, I'm saved and I'm not going to pay the price. Ultimately, I'm not going to go to hell for my sins, which which can be a sign of a lack of true faith, even just saying that. But we also need to remember that even with a confidence and assurance of salvation, like I've been preaching about recently, we need to realize that our sin can have huge and lasting consequences. And it should be just one more reason for us not to even toy with sin, with sins that are tempting us. So watch where you get attached. Your heart, where you set your heart, where you get attached, whether it's to in a romantic relationship or in other things, watch where you get attached, because even the wisest king of all time for Israel was led astray by where his heart was going. But then also give thanks that Jesus is our perfectly faithful king. Jesus has only one bride, and that bride is the church, and he's perfectly faithful to us. And he brings all that peace and prosperity and wisdom without all the sin and unfaithfulness that Solomon did. And it is so good that, as we'll continue to see again and again and again, it's so good that we have King Jesus, because every king we ever had, every king Israel ever had, just wasn't good enough and brought great harm to God's people in different ways. Jesus is the ultimate source of peace and comfort, and we will be with him in perfect peace in his new heavens, new earth someday. And that's a great hope for us. That's Solomon in a quick snapshot. Some of the future weeks, we'll be able to look at scripture itself more directly when we don't have as many passages to cover. Any questions today or comments? Robin?
The books again that you said.
The books that
Solomon wrote.
Okay, so he wrote Song of Solomon, most of Proverbs, probably Ecclesiastes, although he doesn't name himself in that one. And he wrote two Psalms, Psalm 72 and 127. Yes, he appears in 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles. Yes, so not all of Solomon's Proverbs made it into Proverbs. He had many more Proverbs that were not recorded. And also, who was I talking to this week was saying, you think about how much Proverbs talks about the adulterous woman and about, and actually the word for adulterous woman in Proverbs is a foreign woman. And I just, again, like, how can you write that and not, I don't know. And that shows that we all are like that, right? How inconsistent are we all sometimes? It's just Solomon to write that about the dangers of sexual temptation and all these things. And here he goes and marries 700 women. He's an enigmatic figure. Any other questions? I did get that wrong. Just to make sure you got caught that. It's 700 wives, 300 concubines. I said 300 several times before that. So I got that wrong. But
The entire female population
of Sterling. That's not a bad way to. Wow, that's terrible. That's true. All right. That's not too far off. That is right.
That's not bad. Even
right.
You can't win that.
No, it's a terrible, terrible thing. We thanks for Christ and his faithfulness. All right, well, let's go ahead and see.